But I think even though people who believe that men and women are equal, they can indeed in subtle ways endorse prejudiced view of gender roles, for example, even positive ones, like, you know, women are so caring and nurturing and warm. And this is just not helping women, because in many businesses, it's important to be assertive and it's important to be a leader. And when you just box women into a specific role, you're just not helping and you're on the contrary, limiting their reach and their potential.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out our podcast, Understanding Our Place in the World. The podcast is brought to you by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. My name is Philip Cosolino, and I am an experimental social psychologist at Essex. And my guest today is Dr. Marie Juancic, a behavioral scientist at Essex with a PhD in sociocognitive psychology. Over the past 10 years, Marie's work has been aimed at empowering people to make better decisions. This includes helping individuals to understand uncertainty and probabilities and how that understanding can lead to changes in behavior, and it also includes work focused on reducing discrimination and on increasing diversity. Marie and I spoke recently about a number of topics, including the thought processes connected to beliefs and conspiracy theories, and on the social cognitive factors related to misogyny and other forms of discrimination. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Okay, Marie, thanks for coming on the podcast. I'm looking forward to this. How are you doing today?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Why don't you start where we always start on the podcast. Tell us a little bit about your background, as far back as you want to go, academic or not.
I enjoyed my first few years in psychology. Mostly, I enjoyed being a student and partying and, you know, just being independent. And I really started to get into psychology more when I was in my master's, and then I decided I loved studying. I loved just learning new things, and then I thought, well, let's do a PhD then, you know, let's do this some more years and see where it leads us. So at the end of my second year of master, because we do masters in 2 years in France, I got a scholarship, and then I started a PhD, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And then I went to the UK for 1 year of postdoc, and then I applied for a lectureship in a business school. But I loved working in the business school where I was, but I was always feeling like a misfit. I felt I was not quite adapted to the business world, and I wanted to go back to psychology. So then I tried to go back to a psychology department, and that's how I ended up at Essex.
Where were these universities, and what were those universities that you did your undergrad, master's, and PhD, or was it all the same? Was it?
Yeah, I studied all my years for 3 years bachelor, 2 years for the master's, and 3 years for the PhD, all in the same university in Toulouse. I think it's not uncommon in France to have a very linear way to study. We don't, you know, do one thing here, one thing there. University is free anywhere you do it, and so you don't have a clear reason to go somewhere else to continue your studies.
And testing my geography, Toulouse is south of France, right?
Yeah, sorry.
So that must have been terrible.
Yeah, it was really tough, I have to say, you know, too much sun and, you know, like too much nice food with wine. That's really tough years.
It makes me getting my PhD at the University of Minnesota, where it's basically snowing before October. Yeah, I'm just a little jealous. All right, we'll get past that. Let's talk a little bit about your PhD work. What was your thesis work? What was the topic? Kind of what did you infer from all that work?
I worked on words that we use to quantify uncertainty. You know, when we are not sure that something is going to happen, we say, well, there is a chance, it's possible, I'm not sure. So I worked on these particular words and how we can use them to affect people's decision-making. So I thought it was quite interesting, like with Brexit looming. I remember at the beginning of the negotiation when there was a time when Boris Johnson was saying, let's not even talk about no deal because it's just not even on the table. Because we'll have a great deal, of course. And then things became, Well, it's unlikely there will be no deal, but it's a possibility. And then it's becoming a bigger possibility. It's more and more likely that there will be no deal. And now, like yesterday or the day before, I heard it's very likely it will be no deal for Brexit, and there will be no deal between the EU and the UK.
Yeah, and as we record today, it's certainly a tenuous outcome at best at this point.
That's right. So I studied these kind of words and what they mean when people use them, and what they mean also for people who hear them in terms of judgment and decision making.
Because you said speaker and listeners, that's interesting.
Yeah, so the idea is that, like anything in the world, we use words not to describe, but to change. So I'm a big believer in words are not for describing, words are for doing. And like anything, words are not neutral. So when we talk about our uncertainty, we frame the way we communicate it, and we frame it in a way that is not neutral. So if I want you to take on a surgery or a medical treatment, I'll say it has a chance of succeeding. Whereas if I think you should not do it, I could describe the same chances of success as being unlikely to succeed. So I will frame it positively or negatively, but the information remains the same. So it's like the idea of the glass is half full or half empty. It's just applied to uncertainty and probabilities.
And there you said it. I couldn't think of the word framing. That's kind of the language that sort of literature falls under, right? Sort of how you frame a message. That's the scientific term we use, yeah?
Yes, completely. So we have many ways to frame information.
So that was your PhD work. And was there anything surprising, anything that came out of that work that was, to your eyes, an experience novel? Or were you just advancing the sort of framing literature?
My research was mostly incremental, just adding one little bit at a time. But I think what the bigger message would be that language is an incredible toolbox, and that often we are not aware of the way we are using words, and we are not aware that we are framing information, that we are trying to have an influence on people, and that people are trying to have an influence on us without really realizing. Even institutions that really aim to be neutral, like the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, that was created by the United Nations. So their goal is really to be neutral and bring the best evidence available to the people regarding climate change. And of course, as part of their work, they have to quantify probabilities and uncertainties. But the way they do is not as neutral as it should, for example. So although their aim is really to provide the best evidence and in the most objective way, they still frame information in a specific way that can be sometimes detrimental. I think sometimes the boundary between science and activism is a bit is maybe good and maybe not good. Sometimes I feel I wish my science would be more engaged, and I don't know to what extent, you know, to be a good scientist you have to be objective and not engaged, because you know you don't want your personal opinions to come and bias your interpretation of the data. But I also believe for climate change and for discrimination, for a range of issues, I believe we need to be engaged. We need to have an agenda. We need to bring more. Our research need to bring social value. Maybe it doesn't need to, but it's nice if it does.
I agree 100% with what you're saying. This is something that I talk about quite often with colleagues and even sometimes in lectures. I feel like the onus is on us. We need to do a better job of like you said, it's not about passing along an agenda or a belief system, I think, as much as it is about saying we're asking legitimate questions, we're doing it objectively as best we can scientifically, and what we're learning is important and meaningful and can perhaps inform the debates or the, you know, the issues that people around the world are having. But it does feel like psychology is not thought of as doing anything that's really all that relevant. They like to go to economists, and they like to go to other kinds of people who are doing research. But for some reason, psychologists just aren't necessarily being invited to the table that often.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm not sure how to deal with this. You know, like sometimes when I look at my profile, I'm thinking, should I change this? Should I present myself as a psychologist, or should I present myself as a behavioral scientist? What am I anyway? And where can I contribute? So I don't have a clear answer on how we can do better, but I think we should do better, and we should try to occupy the scene. I mean, we have a lot to say. Like now, there is a lot about vaccination and vaccination hesitancy, but what can psychologists contribute to this? And we are experts in human behavior, so that's exactly the kind of issue we can focus on.
Mystery surrounds the high-security lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology that handles the world's most dangerous pathogens, making it the target of conspiracy theories about the origin of the virus.
So you're 100% confident there was no leak, no accident?
I'm confident there's no leak.
100%?
100%.
You're doing some work on issues of misinformation and conspiracy theories and how that people think about and make decisions based on that kind of information. So I'd like to try and start going in that road. I think this is fascinating stuff, especially now that the vaccines and vaccinations are starting to happen, not just here, but around the world. And of course, you know, I know for fact that there are chips in the vaccine that Bill Gates want to, you know, he wants to know where I am at all times. He can't possibly just use my mobile phone and that GPS device that I carry. He's clearly looking to get into my bloodstream, right? Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. And we should all go and burn one or two 5G towers as well.
Yeah, those darn 5G towers.
Yeah, we should really be careful, because I think often, you know, conspiracy theories come from actual real pieces of information that are taken out of their context and then broadcasted in the wrong way or misrepresented, you know, little elements, like, for example, a specific molecule that there is in a vaccine. It's important, and how dangerous it could be is overinflated. So, for example, if you give a big dose of that molecule, it could be dangerous. And so people go all over this particular element and mention it all over and over again, citing a lot of studies showing that this is dangerous. But actually, the amount at which it is present in the vaccine is actually making it completely okay, and the body actually produces it and deals with it just fine. So a few years ago, it was about, I think, mercury or aluminium. I don't remember what they were saying, that there is a vaccine, and saying, oh my goodness, you're not going to let someone inject yourself some aluminium or something that could be really dangerous, but it's actually not.
That makes sense, because, you know, to get someone down a rabbit hole of sort of misinformation, conspiracy theory kind of stuff, I guess it's good to, you know, take baby steps, right? And you start with factual, truthful stuff. But there's, you know, one of the most dominant and fast growing conspiracy theories is this thing called QAnon in the States, which politically is about, you know, particular members of, you know, the Democratic Party and celebrities and the elite in the left of political spectrums, basically, you know, cannibalizing children, drinking their blood. And you just got the sense where it's like, that one doesn't seem like there's any truth.
Yeah, I agree that it doesn't have to, not all conspiracy theories have or false information have a hint of truth in them. Sometimes it's just a person who has some form of authority, like Donald Trump, who launches false information, and just because of their authority and their position in the world, their social prestige, then it becomes real information for people. And certainly it brings them a form of control. It's nice to have the feeling of knowing. It's even better if you know and the others don't. And it makes you feel special. So there is a range of reasons why you would turn to something, a belief that is completely false. It doesn't have to have any truth in it at all.
We teach our students all the time that that's just a core part of being human, right? That desire, that need to make sense, to put the world into some rubric that makes sense, right? Because the idea of living in a world that is incoherent and chaotic, we teach this regularly at intro levels and beyond, that we have this need, a motivational state of trying to put the world into sense. But that's what's so strange, right? It's like that, that's the process and that's the underlying need that we have. How we get there and what we're comfortable, the position we're comfortable ending in is just so fascinating that that makes sense to people to say there are the biggest, Bill Gates wants to put a chip in my blood and, you know, Joe Biden and other Democrats and liberals around the world eat children. And that, that now the world makes sense to me. And it's just, it's still the same process. It's just fascinating how, what the ride that people are willing to go on to get there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, but what is fascinating about human psychology in general is that even you, even me, we know what would make us happy. We know what would keep us healthy, but we don't do it. I mean, I know I should work every day. I know I should not eat too much fat, and I know I should not eat too much sugar. And yet, you know, I love a good burger, and I'm going to love to eat candies, and I don't work as I should. So sometimes we feel, but these people, they are crazy. You know, why would they believe in this? But in the meantime, we are not good at being rational either. We are not the best we could. And it doesn't, and the worst thing is that for them, for people who believe in conspiracy theories or people like us who are certainly not believing in them, what we do has negative consequences for us, for our future, for our health, for people around us, you know. So not wearing a mask is negative for your health, and refusing to be vaccinated is certainly leading to greater risks than actually getting vaccinated. And I'm talking about any form of vaccine, the flu or COVID-19, and eating healthy is important, et cetera, et cetera. So we are all to different degrees, not being as rational as we could, and also not being as healthy and happy as we could be.
I think the beliefs in a lot of these things are more diagnostic of just how wrong things have gone in society, for at least as it's perceived by people, whether they're being spun by political ideological perspectives or if it's just literally kitchen table sort of stuff. I don't have what I used to have, and the little bit I do is slipping away, and I'm trying to. So, you know, if someone tells me they can help me and I'll listen to whatever it is they're saying, I think the point I'm trying to make, you know, clumsily, is that we can laugh about the chips in the vaccine and QAnon and this kind of stuff. But at the same time, these are human beings on this planet. They have families. They are not bad people, many of them. And it's just so important, I think, at some level to kind of figure out what is it that we need to do? Do you know, have you done that work? Are you aware of the work? How do we get to them and say, look, all respect, we understand what you're feeling, what you're thinking. Let's start thinking differently about things.
So I feel the same. Actually, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was so worried, et cetera. Like I felt really, really worried. And when I saw, you know, conspiracy theories, new ones cropping every day, I felt that's not possible. People cannot believe this. And you know, I thought, and it's true to some extent, that the media overemphasized the extreme, and I felt they were overblowing it. So we did some research on this, and actually I was surprised that more people than I expected did believe in some conspiracy theories, like the new coronavirus was bioengineered by China as a weapon, but you know, on the other hand, the conspiracy theories that it spread via 5G was not much endorsed, although I would have thought that it would have been as popular. But no, clearly the fact that it could be a bioweapon, like 20% of the people said yes. In some
20%?
Yeah.
Wow. And you're right, though, because my memory, and this is just like the availability heuristic at play, is that 5G thing was bigger. That got a lot of attention in the media. They were showing people burning them. And so my guess was that was equally held. And you're saying, no, that was significantly lower than that.
Yeah, much lower. But I think also it depends how you're wording the question to people. So in our study, we we asked people whether they believe that 5G was used to disseminate the virus or was used as a vector of the virus. And so people really didn't agree with this, or only a minority did agree with it. But maybe if we had asked them, do you think the 5G network is weakening people's immune system? Maybe then more people would have agreed, you know, you have more or less a bold statement in connection to the role of the 5G network. So that could explain it. But the possibility that China is trying to attack Europe and the US is a very popular one.
How do you get through? I don't know what to do. I don't know what the question is. It's just such a fascinating, rich history that you're battling actual truth, perceived truth, right? It's like,
I think you put your finger on something that is really interesting. It's the idea of trust. So if you distrust the government, you are much more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. And if you don't trust the medical community or scientists, you're much more likely to refuse to be vaccinated and endorse misinformation and conspiracy theories. I think trust is an essential condition for people to endorse real facts. But we need to understand, we need to help people understand science. For example, we have to be clear that science is not always correct, and that sometimes science says something and that not 100% of the scientists are going to agree. But if 99% of the scientists say that climate change is happening and 1% say it doesn't, it's not the case, then you just have to rely on the majority. And that 1%, this 1% who dissent, it doesn't mean they're right. It just means that, you know, there statistically there will be some random events, or there will be people who are, you know, paid by Total or, you know, the oil industry to do their research, and they are not really objective there. But I think building trust is such a tough enterprise because it's so hard to win trust and it's so easy to lose it. You know, you have one example of one scientist who misbehaves, and then, you know, it's the whole scientific community who pays for it.
What the average person who's not a scientist is looking for is clarity, answers, a small r religious perspective on the world, right? And that meaning just here's the truth about what's happening in my world, right? And what we do is we say, well, it's a process, right? We might be wrong, right? I mean, it's science, it's probabilistic. And we're not, so we're coming to them saying, we understand that you're in an intense, motivated, you know, seeking of truth and certainty. We want you to listen to us, and we can't provide that.
I agree that, you know, sometimes when I give a talk about uncertainty, I'm asking people, who wants to feel uncertain here? Like, I mean, thinking that people want uncertainty is like thinking people want to be punched in the face. I mean, everybody wants to be certain, you know. Everybody wants to know what will happen tomorrow. But what they want even more is to be told the truth. So if you're not sure, I prefer to know. And everybody, we say that when you ask people, do you want scientists to acknowledge when they are not certain? They say yes. People want it. They prefer the person who will say, I know for sure. They will prefer that. But if you ask them, if there is any uncertainty, should we admit it? People say yes. And I agree with this, because in the long term, if you pretend you're certain, if you present information as being certain, you will be wrong. Because it's easy to be wrong, you know, when you're certain. I mean, if you say tomorrow it will be 24 degrees Celsius, it's a very specific prediction that you make with certainty. Whereas if you say, like in the weather forecast, there is a chance of drizzle and maybe the temperature will be around between 20 and 30 degrees. And you know, if you present the information by acknowledging your uncertainty and you help people to prepare for a number of outcomes, I think it's more helpful in the long run.
You're starting to do, or you have been doing work on misogyny and prejudice and reducing prejudice and such like that. So maybe we can kind of, is this an active program for you right now?
Yes, it is. So sometimes I find it difficult to define my research area like as a whole, but I think really what I'm interested in is trying to empower people to make better decisions, you know, like to have more positive outcomes in their lives than before. And I think discrimination and prejudice is an example of a particular case where I think people make suboptimal decisions. So imagine you are hiring someone for your business and you have 5 applicants and the best one maybe is black. And why wouldn't you hire this particular person? And that's, for me, is an example of just suboptimal decision quality. And I think prejudice in general, why would you treat someone in a different way because of their gender or because of their ethnicity or because of their sexual orientation or for whatever reason, you know, like if there is no rational reason for doing this, just people should not do it.
Well, I think this is really interesting. I just gave my long 2-hour lecture on stereotypes, prejudice, discrimination for our intro students, and I do that regularly at Essex. So much of that work is focused on understanding the processes and trying to figure out ways to obviously reduce all of them, stereotypes, prejudice, discrimination. But I'm not aware of that much work. And again, that's my ignorance on it, which it sounds like a really interesting perspective to say, rather than thinking about it as like, well, you know, this is the wrong way to treat other people or, you know, but more of like self-interested, like, why would you do this? This is just only at the end of the day harming you and your own potential downstream benefits by, you know, is that a very common approach or is that sort of novel?
I don't know whether it's common or not. It's just because my background is in decision making and so to make sense of, to integrate better this line of research on prejudice and discrimination, I just put it in the framework I already know. And for me, it's really about help, like trying to see what helps people make better decisions. But of course, I have a social bias there. I'm interested in sexism, partly because I'm a woman and I can see sexist behaviors regularly. So I just try to fit a new line of research within an existing mm-hmm. framework. And I also try to help people understand that it's not all about attitudes and you know, you can be very fair. You can be a person who believes in equality and yet be someone who foster a culture of sexism or racism by other ways than your direct behavior.
Yeah, I was in a different context. I was discussing at the end of the lecture. I didn't actually teach about them, but I pointed my students if they wanted to learn more about something. I think it's microaggressions in the context of race, right? And you imagine being someone of color walking down a street, and as you get closer to a car, you hear all the doors locking, right? And it's just it's just this kind of like, imagine what that does to that person, right? And what they must be feeling at that moment, you know? And even if the people in the car are not necessarily the classic prejudiced, discriminatory person, what you've just done here, the message you've just sent is horrible and it's aggressive and it hurts. And I imagine I'm imagining that's kind of what you're talking about, is that there are ways that you can see misogyny at play from people who don't even know they're doing it.
Yes, completely. I think there has been a lot of progress regarding discrimination against a number of minorities, or I don't know how to categorize women because they are not minorities, but against a number of groups. But so the first thing is to realize if there is an issue and to say, okay, there is an issue, let's try to address it. And regarding women's rights, for example, there is a clear realization that there is an issue and a will to address it. But I think even though people who believe that men and women are equal, they can indeed in subtle ways endorse prejudiced view of gender roles, for example, even positive ones, like, you know, women are so caring and nurturing and warm. And this is just not helping women, because in many businesses, it's important to be assertive and it's important to be a leader. And when you just box women into a specific role, you're just not helping, and you are on the contrary limiting their reach and their potential. So, you know, especially paternal type sexism can be damaging to women and to their vocational goals. But even without explicitly endorsing a fact that could be negative, you know, often I will hear something sexist and I will not, or something that could be sexist, but it's not clear because it's often ambiguous. You don't know really what people mean by it. I think racism, sexism, a lot of isms are tied to people's intention. And because it's tied to people's intention, it's easy to dismiss them and not to address them. And I think by not addressing them, we are just basically supporting them.
This is true at all levels. Over the weekend, Dr. Jill Biden, the wife of President-elect Joe Biden, there was someone in the Wall Street Journal who wrote an op-ed piece basically belittling her. I mean, that's my perspective, but it seems to be what most people's read is on this, and basically argued that this doctor should probably come out of her, you know, the sort of honorific kind of, the title isn't really, my understanding is perhaps it's a bit of that sort of like honorary doctorate. I don't know that for sure, but it was written as if that was the way it was written, as this is more an honorary thing and you should probably lose that. And he even called her something like kiddo. And the right away, the backlash was just, no man would ever get this op-ed written about them. And it's just so fascinating that here we are, 2020, we have a woman vice president-elect in Kamala Harris, and you just, the Me Too movement, everything, and yet the Wall Street Journal, like a pretty big newspaper, this isn't like some web blog, you know, basically just tore into this woman who's incredible, apparently, by all accounts. And it's, here we go, right? It's like we're still dealing with it, clearly.
I think it's just a real shame that the Wall Street Journal published this piece on a woman who has a PhD. It's a real PhD. It's not a honorary good. Title.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that's the way the writer spun it. Yeah. So that's right. I wasn't clear. I was like, wow, that sounds like you're basically saying this isn't real. And I was like, I always assumed it was, but I didn't know.
I think it's a PhD in educational science.
Yeah, she's a teacher.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's just shameful that they published it, and of course it's shameful the guy wrote it. And I found already a lot of fun memes, you know, online, making fun of the guy who wrote it, because it seems he feels threatened, you know, by an academic woman who is educated and has a clear senior position and a role to play in the American. It's not government because she's not part of the government, but the American political life, let's call it. Yeah. But this is a good example of how for women in general as a group, there are more battles to fight for equality.
How has the, from data that you know or collected yourself, has the Me Too movement over the last maybe 10 years, I don't know how long back that actually goes, but roughly in the last decade or so, and 5 years certainly, has that movement swayed people in a positive direction, or is it just further polarized and created more debate?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that's the real answer. I wish the Me Too movement had inspired more women to, or more people, men and women, and everybody to hold their ground and fight for their rights. But I'm not as optimistic. You know, when I see a lot of news pieces saying now the speech of the voice of women is heard, and now women are will address issues about sexual assault, and they will say if they are raped, and they will say if they are harassed. But I don't believe in that. The voice of vulnerable minorities, and I will put women in this, is not heard. And it's difficult for victims to come forward, even now after the Me Too movement. It is difficult to testify about harassment, sexual and otherwise, now, today. And I know examples of people who have been harassed and who told me it's I cannot go forward, because if I go forward and I complain to my HR people, for example, I'm going to be in trouble. My life at work won't be possible anymore. And I respect that they don't go forward, and I understand the position. So I believe that the media who says that's it, you know, with the Me Too movement, we have solved the issue. I totally believe this is not true. I think it's still incredibly difficult to come forward when you have been a victim of abuse. And I think it's incredibly brave as well to do it. And I think not only it's difficult to come forward, but it's actually difficult to get justice being done. So no, I don't think things have changed as much as they should have.
The more benevolent types of sexism that exist, and the more seemingly less, you know, or more positive, less negative ones, those must, you know, I can't imagine how difficult it's going to be to overcome some of those, right? Because it's even the classic sort of, let me get the door for you. It's all this kind of, it's just so ingrained sometimes in the way people live their lives that they don't realize they're perpetuating or enhancing beliefs that are based purely on sex and gender. And so if you can't even get past the idea of, like, how do we treat women who've been, you know, sexually assaulted or raped? How are we going to deal with the fact that there are these more positive, seemingly less egregious ways of behaving?
Yes, I agree. But I think the two are going together. I think the little jokes are part of the problem, because they make it look like it's the norm. They make it look like it's normal to treat women and men differently, or people from different ethnicities. I think we need to address the jokes to send a message that the norm is not that. That's not okay to make a joke about this. And you will look like you're an annoying, how do you call it? You know, you are like a buzzkill and a joy killer. If you tell off someone for saying something like this, you will be judged more negatively. And there is research showing that. But you will also feel good that you have done the right thing.
You know, there's plenty of men out there who won't ever physically assault a woman, and, you know, won't ever, you know, treat her, you know, in the way that we saw, you know, Harvey Weinstein treat women, apparently. But they'll laugh at all the jokes about that women are bad drivers and, you know, whatever. You go on, and you just think, man, it's all one of the same, and we just don't see it.
Yeah, that's why with one of my students, Hazel Sayer, we are trying to work on how we challenge sexism when it occurs and how we can do it so that it's constructive of change and a positive outcome for everybody, the person who is confronted and the person who has confronted. So challenging sexism can actually be done in very gentle, nice ways that can bring positive outcomes to everybody in the situation. So, for example, and I think that's an interesting one, because most of the time it's ambiguous whether the person is prejudiced or not. And so, but just asking, what do you mean? I didn't understand. Why did you say that? But what do you mean? Expressing confusion instead of confrontation is helping the person reflect, well, I mean, women don't drive so well. Well, no, actually, I think the statistics show the opposite. Well, but you see, if you don't make the person reflect a tiny bit and bring along their reasoning where they will line up men versus women or people from a specific ethnicity versus the majority, then it's hard to tackle it. But if you just question them a little, nicely, kindly, with a positive intention at heart, then you can, it has more potential to bring positive change. And I'm not being prescriptive here, because I believe that any form of challenging is actually legitimate. But I'm just trying to find a way for everybody to get something positive out of it.
It's almost sort of sounds like it's like a bit Socratic, like the Socratic method, just a little bit of like, let me just probe a little bit here. And I imagine there would be lots of people out there who would have maybe, you know, told the joke, you know, to get the laugh and the chuckle that would be sexist in nature, even on a small scale, and that would get asked that kind of question, where for many people, they probably would be like, well, it's just the thing, like they wouldn't even be able to say the thing you said, which is, well, women are bad drivers, right? Like it's just a joke, right? It's like, it's almost like it's become so embedded in our, it's like how we can just smooth the conversation. I can, you know, I don't know people here at the party. I'm trying to get known. I can make a little joke about my wife and, you know, my girlfriend not driving well. Everyone will chuckle because it's what we do. And yet it's like, I don't even have to believe it. What I'm looking for is some way of just like a transaction almost, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just currency, like I mentioned earlier. It just gets me in the door. And that's insidious in a way, right? So that's the interesting, the dynamic here is it's the small things can sometimes be the most insidious.
Yeah, and the smallest thing is actually not to do anything at all. You know, the smallest thing is not the person who says the joke. The smallest thing is the person who listens to it without answering.
All right, Marie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you very much, Philip.
All right, well, have a good holiday break, and I'll see you hopefully around the building sometime in 2023.
Maybe.
Bye.
Thank you, Philip.
And thank you once again for checking out the Understanding Our Place in the World podcast. This podcast was produced by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. Make sure to check us out again, as we'll have another interview for you to enjoy in the coming weeks.